Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ronnie Duggar, co-founder of the Alliance for Democracy, who discusses the ongoing investigation into irregularities in the 2004 election, focusing on Ohio. Joy Gordon, a lawyer and professor of philosophy, who examines charges of corruption being leveled at the United Nations Oil for Food program in Iraq. And Luis Rumbo, attorney and communications director for the Cuban American Alliance Education Fund, who analyzes the Bush administration's targeting of three organizations for alleged violations of the Cuba travel ban. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The omnibus $388 billion spending bill recently enacted eliminated the funding for research on bunker-buster nuclear weapons and a new generation of battlefield-ready tactical nuclear weapons. Congressman Ed Markey, a Massachusetts Democrat, called the budget cuts the biggest victory for arms control on Capitol Hill in a decade. According to the Chicago Tribune, a bipartisan coalition opposed the nuclear bunker buster because it sends a contradictory message to the world community at the same time the Bush administration is trying to pressure Iran and North Korea to give up their nuclear weapons programs. The Bush White House had planned to spend $500 million over the next few years on the bunker buster weapon, officially called the Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator. Speaking at a forum on the future of nuclear weapons last summer, Ohio Republican Congressman David Hobson called the administration's push for a new generation of nuclear weapons a very provocative and very aggressive policy that undermines our moral authority to say that other nations should give up nuclear weapons. The Guardian newspaper reports that a secret memo further implicates Mark Thatcher, son of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, in the failed coup plot to overthrow the government of oil-rich Equatorial Guinea. Thatcher is identified as MT in a memo written by British mercenary Simon Mann, the alleged mastermind behind the plot to topple the government of President Obiang. The memo is now in the hands of prosecutors in South Africa, where Thatcher will go on trial next April. The memo stated that the other plotters needed to keep quiet on Thatcher's role or the success of the coup would be endangered. The memo also revealed that Simon Mann, an accused former British intelligence officer, was eager to get the backing of the U.S. government and American oil companies that dominate the economy of Equatorial Guinea. The regime of President Obiang has imposed a 34-year jail sentence on accused coup plotter Nick de Toit, a South African arms dealer. 11 other foreign mercenaries got a sentence of 17 years in jail. Severo Moto, who would have taken over the country if the plot had succeeded, received a 63-year sentence in absentia. In late October, Baptist preacher Joseph Dantica fled the violence and death threats by neighborhood gangs from his parish in Haiti and sought political asylum in Miami. Traveling with his son Maxo, the 81-year-old minister was placed in an airport holding area for 20 hours and later transferred to the Chrome Detention Center run by the Department of Homeland Security. At the time, immigration agents also seized the minister's briefcase that held prescription medicine for a prostate problem and high blood pressure. At a hearing on November 1st, Reverend Dantica became ill and fell back into a chair motionless. It took 2 hours to get him to a hospital. The preacher died on November 3rd from pancreatitis, 5 days after being detained by U.S. immigration authorities. While still in the hearing room, his son Maxo was shocked to see his father's dire condition. He saw that vomit had blocked the hole in the preacher's throat, where he used a voice box after having his larynx removed. Florida Congressman Kendrick Mack is calling for an independent investigation of the Haitian minister's death, declaring that Haitians are treated at the same level as livestock coming into the U.S. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
While the U.S. media has focused much attention on street demonstrations in Kiev, where thousands are protesting what they believe to be a stolen election in the nation of Ukraine, the press corps here at home largely continues to ignore disturbing questions about the validity of America's recent presidential election. Although Democratic Party candidate Senator John Kerry conceded to President Bush the day after the November 2nd election, political parties and citizens groups are demanding an investigation into voting irregularities around the country and a recount in the state of Ohio. The Green and Libertarian parties recently succeeded in raising the required funds to file for a recount in Ohio, where the unofficial margin of victory for Mr. Bush was 136,000 votes. Questions about the veracity of the election results revolve around major discrepancies between exit polling and the final tallies in many states, a GOP-initiated voter suppression campaign, and the lack of an adequate number of voting machines in some key Democratic districts, causing inordinately long lines. Also under scrutiny in Ohio are the tens of thousands of uncounted, spoiled, and provisional ballots, and the inability to recount electronic votes where totals are susceptible to manipulation. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ronnie Duggar, co-founder of the Alliance for Democracy, who as far back as 1988 warned against the dangers of computerized voting. Here, Duggar discusses the ongoing investigation into irregularities in the 2004 election and what's at stake for the nation's democracy.
Well, the broad problem is structural, Scott. About 40 million votes were counted in computers with no ballot made by the voter available to recount. Therefore, about a third of the election was counted by anonymous and unknown and unidentified computer programmers operating entirely within the computers. And these programmers are hired by private companies that have privatized American elections. As a friend of mine in Indiana says, we've gone from the secrecy of the ballot to the secrecy of the vote count. In that situation, and I would never have said this for any of the half century of elections I have lived through as an adult, this is the first election that is invalid on its face. It's democratically invalid. You do not have a valid election where a third of the votes cannot be recounted by the people who cast them. That is an invalid election. More to the point is, why has this system, about which I personally have been warning since 1988, the direct recording electronic system with no way to recount the votes, kept gaining ground to the point now where it's a third of all the systems that count votes in the country. In addition, another 75 or 80 million votes are counted by computers, which are operating card readers and interpreting what the cards are reading. So essentially, we have 5 out of 6 votes now being counted by anonymous computer programmers hired by private election companies. Now, the officials of these election companies have politics. They have a right to have politics. However, it turns out that the largest company, which counted perhaps 65 million votes in the United States, more than half of them on November 2nd, their systems did, is an essentially Republican organization, ES&S of Nebraska, which played a crucial vote-counting role at the beginning of the career of Senator Chuck Hagel, the Republican senator from Nebraska. The company now is half-owned by the Omaha World Herald, a stick-in-the-mud right-wing newspaper in Omaha. And a fourth of it is owned by Michael McCarthy, who is a leading supporter of Republican causes and indeed was the campaign treasurer for Senator Hagel in two of his Senate races. These are the people who hire the programmers that count more than half the votes in the United States, and it turns out that 40 million of those votes being counted in the computers cannot be recounted except in the computers. Now, what happened in the election, Scott, is that none of the outcomes, or very few of the outcomes, were close enough to trigger recounts. Therefore, what we get is an election in which we do not know, and we never will know, who won. Whether or not the election was stolen from Mr. Bush is a question I'm still meditating on and studying, reading about, deciding my position on it. I am pretty powerfully persuaded by the argument that was literally almost all the errors going in Mr. Bush's favor in the computerized vote counting. The example from Jonathan Simon is that it's like having 40 spins of the penny and they all come up the same way. You better examine the penny. But to say that the election is stolen at this point, well, I'm still studying it.
Ronnie Duggar, what would an investigation, a full investigation of the Ohio vote count look like?
Well, it's already begun. There have been some public hearings. The NAACP is involved. Common Cause, Public Citizen, local Ohio organizations, the Alliance for Democracy are involved. Cliff Arnebeck is an attorney who's helping lead this inquiry. And these are investigations into the suppression of votes. The suppression of votes mainly by the means of assigning scandalously few vote-counting machines to scandalously many voters in the minority districts that go 90% for Kerry. So that if you want to vote for Kerry, you might have to wait 4 hours or 10 hours. Whereas if you live in the better-off districts, you can vote in 15 minutes and go on out to the country club for a round of golf. Is this criminal activity? Does this violate the Voters' Rights Act? Was it a deliberate pattern? Was it a conspiracy? That's one of the questions. Another of them is, look at the computer programs that counted the votes in those major counties surrounding Cincinnati that gave 100,000 more votes to the little-known candidate for the Supreme Court than it gave to Kerry. Let's look at the computer programming of those elections. Look at the source codes. But to do that, of course, you have to get a court order. Third thing that I would like to see the Ohio investigation, if it occurs, do, is under the authority of the Supreme Court, which conducts investigations of that kind in Ohio, so I'm informed, put the companies that counted the votes in Ohio under subpoena and subpoena their computer programmers. Let these people be brought forth into the light of day and explain exactly how they counted Ohio's votes.
Ronnie, what's at stake here for the democracy if this country doesn't undertake the repair of the electoral system?
These Republicans aren't interested in a two-party government there. They want a one-party government. And if they get everything they want, like abolishing the filibuster and then appointing all the Supreme Court judges they want to because the Democrats won't be able to stop it, if they get that kind of thing going, and then if you know they've already announced they want weapons in space, we have full-spectrum dominance. We're going to have weapons in space circling every nation in the world 24 hours, day and night, overhead, and unreachable by the weapons of any other country as of present. Well, if we get that kind of dominance, we're talking about the end of the United States as a free country. We're also talking about the emergence of the United States as the enemy of the peace-loving nations of the world. We're talking about the development of a multipolar world, Europe, India, China, other parts of the world, which are going to start militarizing against the United States. You're talking about another worldwide arms race. What's about to happen to the United States cannot at all be compassed in the question of a corrupted vote-counting system. A corrupted vote-counting system is just a part of what we're dealing with. I guess, I've been around some time. I guess I've never seen such a challenge for the citizens of this country in my lifetime. Our position is that of citizens whose country changes from a democracy into something else during their active lifetimes. One thinks of the Greek citizens as they themselves voted to attack Persia, or the citizens of Rome as Rome became a dictatorial empire, or of the citizens of revolutionary France under the militarized Napoleon. Are the citizens of the Weimar Republic. That's where we are.
That was Ronnie Duggar, co-founder of the Alliance for Democracy, who early on warned against the dangers of electronic voting. Visit the Alliance website at www.thealliancefordemocracy.org. Read Duggar's pre-election article titled, How They Could Steal the Election This Time, online at www.thenation.com. The United Nations is under attack for its handling of the $64 billion Iraq Oil for Food program, which provided much of Iraq's population with food and basic necessities between 1996 and the U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Charges of fraud and mismanagement of billions of dollars, including kickbacks funneled to former dictator Saddam Hussein, have been leveled not just at the Oil for Food program within the U.N., but at the world body itself, leading to calls by some for the resignation of U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan. payments reportedly made to Anand Sun Kojo by a Swiss inspection firm that had contracts with the UN's Oil for Food program are among the allegations being investigated by U.S. congressional committees and an independent commission at the UN. The scandal has been widely reported in the American press as the Bush administration expressed anger at the Secretary General for his public criticism of the U.S. decision to invade Iraq. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Joy Gordon, a lawyer and professor of philosophy at Fairfield University in Connecticut, who is completing a book about the effect of U.N. sanctions against Iraq and the role of the Oil for Food program. She explains that the creation and operation of the program were approved by the U.N. Security Council, with the U.S. playing an especially active role so that Washington can't escape responsibility for any fraud and or mismanagement that occurred.
I think if we look at the 9 congressional investigations, the massive amount of news coverage, the huge reports coming out of different bodies of the U.S. government, it's hard to describe this as anything other than a feeding frenzy. The attacks on the U.N. have been vitriolic. They've been incredibly distorted. They present partial information. They obscure some of the most basic information you have to understand about the U.N., and end up concluding that the U.N. is incompetent and corrupt and a failed institution. If you look at the Oil for Food program, that's certainly not grounds to believe that the U.N. is characterized by this kind of massive institutional failure. In fact, the reality is nowhere like that. There's a fundamental difference within the U.N. between the Security Council and the Secretariat and the other agencies. The Security Council is a political body, something like our Congress. Its decisions are made not by Kofi Annan, but by the 15 members who sit on the council. And then there are 5 permanent members, of which the U.S. is one. And those permanent members also have veto power, so they have an extraordinary kind of weight. And many of the things that the U.N. is being accused of doing, allowing Saddam to choose who he would do his business with, for example, has absolutely nothing to do with Kofi Annan or any other part of the U.N. It is a decision by the vote of the Security Council in which the U.S. was in agreement. So I'll give you an example. The claim is that the Iraqi government padded its import contract so that all the goods it imported under the humanitarian provisions of the Oil for Food program, an extra 5% or 10% was added on, and that came back to them in cash under the table. And the claim is, how could the U.N. have been so incompetent as to fail to notice these systematic widespread kickbacks going on? Well, the answer is that every single one of those contracts was circulated not only to UN staff, but in fact had to be approved by every member of the Security Council, including the U.S. And of the 15 members who reviewed these contracts, the U.S. was by far the most active. The U.S. had an enormous staff of 60 staff members who reviewed these contracts. And the U.S. was certainly willing to block contracts for other reasons. So, for example, as of July 2002, the U.S. had placed something like $5 billion of goods, of critical humanitarian goods, on hold, claiming security concerns. And these range from everything like legitimate security concerns to, for example, any generator that could produce electricity. The U.S. blocked, including generators necessary to run water and sewage treatment plants. So the U.S. was no stranger to the use of its veto power to block contracts. But of all of these contracts that it reviewed, something like 36,000 in total, there is no occasion on which the U.S. said, there's a price irregularity here, perhaps there's a kickback, we need to stop this. Even though the U.S. had exactly the same information the U.N. did. And in fact, the U.N. staff on 70 occasions, when pricing irregularities were so high that there was obviously a kickback going on, went before the Security Council committee and said to everyone, including the U.S. representative, here's a contract where the pricing is so out of the norm, we really are concerned about the possibility of a kickback. Do you want to block the contract? And on those 70-plus occasions, the U.S. did nothing. When the U.S. was given documentation showing that kickbacks were taking place on particular contracts, it did nothing. And it was those countries that had the power to block the contracts, not the staffing of the U.N.
Where do all these investigations stand? I mean, do you know when they might be concluded and what the possible outcome or ramifications might be for the U.N.?
Well, if you look at how extreme and how vitriolic and consistent these attacks are, and who they're aimed at, because it's not only the oil for food staff, for example, it's Kofi Annan. It's an attack on the entire institutional credibility of the United Nations. And I think we cannot overstate how damaging that is to the future of international governance and the possibility of living in a world that's actually governed in accordance with the principles of international law. I think that the future of international law is at stake, and that if we look particularly at the Bush administration, which for 4 years has been openly contemptuous of many of the most basic vehicles of international law, the International Criminal Court, the Kyoto Accords, on and on and on, I think this is a matter of tremendous concern.
That was Joy Gordon, a lawyer and professor of philosophy at Fairfield University, who is completing a book about UN sanctions against Iraq. Her forthcoming article on the subject will appear in the December 2004 issue of Harper's Magazine, which can be read online at www.harpers.org. In October, IFCO Pastors for Peace, the Venceremos Brigade, and the Cuban-American Alliance Education Fund all received requests to furnish information from the U.S. government's Office of Foreign Assets Control. OFAC's request directs these organizations to list all trips to Cuba with telephone numbers, dates, names, and addresses for each traveler, with detailed itineraries for each day. The groups also need to provide itemization and copies of all payment records, receipts for airline tickets, Cuban airport departure taxes, meals, and other detailed information. All were given 20 days to respond and were warned that violations or failure to respond could result in the imposition of civil and/or criminal penalties, and that information provided could serve as the basis for further civil enforcement action. OFAC is in charge of tracking down and identifying international sources of terrorist financing. However, the Cuba travel ban also falls under OFAC's jurisdiction, which includes monitoring U.S. citizens traveling to Cuba. Currently, OFAC dedicates the equivalent of 21 full-time employees to enforce the Cuba travel ban, while only 16 people are assigned to the search for al-Qaeda's sources of financial support. Luis Rumbo is an attorney, a frequent traveler to Cuba, and communications director for the Cuban-American Alliance Education Fund. Your reporter, Denise Manzari, spoke with Rumbo, who analyzes the Bush administration's targeting of these three organizations for alleged violations of the Cuba travel ban.
I haven't seen the letters for IFCO and Venceremos Brigade, but I'm assuming they're very much like the one that Caius got. And that one is a broad-ranging interrogatory. There are provisions in the rules that you have to keep certain records for 5 years. Now, the government has demanded that CAIF turn over a list of all of those people and their addresses and phone numbers. They want a detailed itinerary for all of the trips taken. Under the rules, you're supposed to be there full-time to do your work on behalf of the handicapped and then come back, which has been done. But you can imagine the paperwork and the bookkeeping involved here, going back through 5 years of everybody who ever went, what they did, and, of course, a phone number and address. It's not only a huge burden on the organization that gets that kind of request, but it's also a way of warning everybody else, all those hundreds and hundreds of people, that you are going to be investigated also. And if you multiply that by the number of organizations like IFCO and Venceremos who are getting similar letters, you can imagine that practically everybody involved one way or another with trips to Cuba is going to get this kind of warning shot, which may well develop into more than a warning.
By the organizations, if they decide to furnish any of this information, that will then enable OFAC to go after these people individually and question them extensively, no?
That's correct. That's correct. And it puts the organization then in a pretty difficult position. If they don't do it, then you can be sure that they will start getting fined or their licenses will be not renewed or denied, because there will be dead bodies hung around as an example for other people. If they do cooperate and do, after all, they're operating under rules and they're supposed to do this because those are the rules, the conditions of the license, then there's going to be probably thousands of people across the nation that are going to be concerned, and properly so, about whether they're waiting for the other shoe to fall, whether there's something else that's going to happen on the part of OFAC.
This seems to be going on quietly in the background while the United States and the American people are focused on the war in Iraq. What do you think the role of the media is to bring this to the public? Not very many people are hearing about this.
No, it's pretty outrageous. Folks at your station are one of the few groups of people that continue to focus on these issues and get the word out, and they do that in a very, very significant media market with lots of great folks up there and listen to this station and elsewhere and internet.
And what would you say to people listening to this program that perhaps were thinking of going to Cuba for the first time?
Well, I think it's wonderful for people to continue to go to Cuba. I think you have to be realistic that it is not a very favorable time to go there without potential consequences. I have to say that clearly there still continue to be ways going through other third countries, for example, and there are still occasionally trips that are legal, and there are possibilities under a general license for professionals and journalists and so on to go down there. So if they're really interested, I suggest they should look around, maybe read the OFAC rules for the list of the kind of activities that are still permitted, and try to get one of those.
Although they're considerably curtailing cultural and educational exchanges.
Oh, sure. The university exchanges, I think, were limited now to, they have to demonstrate that when they go down there, they are acting to communicate the official position of the United States regarding Cuba.
That was Luis Rumbo, attorney and communications director for the Cuban American Alliance Education Fund. For more information, contact CAIEF at area code 805-627-1959 or visit their website at www.cubamer.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.